Tell me about the stories that you write. Why do you choose to write plays?
Wow. Well, I started as an actor and then went on to be a director and then lastly started writing plays. So probably the reason I write plays is because it's my medium. It's the medium in which I think and in which I function as an artist. Mm-hmm. Most readily, anyway. The stories I write, they have a lot to do, I would say that, I'm going to caveat this first. I don't set out to deliver a message of any particular kind. Mm-hmm. I set out to make art, art at the highest level of which I am capable, art that I would want to see. I set out to entertain. I do. That said, I do believe that like an artist's work in this world is to be a thinker as well as an implementer of whatever artistic form they happen to practice. And it is to keep sort of society in a state of perpetual dialogue with itself, which I think is essential for a healthy society. So while I don't write to deliver a message of any particular kind, I do write to contribute to the art that is alive in the world today and to contribute to that conversation. So it matters a lot to me what I'm writing about. It matters because like what you put into the world really matters, but it also matters because it's going to take me like 3 years to write a play. I better care. You know, I better care a lot about what I'm writing about. Frequently, my work involves taking characters, people, ideas. No, mostly characters and people who are traditionally on the outskirts of mainstream narrative as we know it and putting them center stage and then just seeing what happens. Usually what happens is, there are a few great stories in the world. There's great love stories. There's great adventure stories. There's great tragedies. You put, a traditionally marginalized character in the center of that. Those are the stories that happen like they would to any character, but I think it makes a difference and shifts how we view the world to tell those stories about, there's such a weird thing in our canon of literature that sort of codified what men are, what women are, what, who gets to be the lead that has always bothered me. It bothered me when I was an actor, you know, for obvious reasons. It bothered me when I was a director, but then it didn't really affect me because I just don't direct that work. And they're brilliant stories, but somehow the mass of them through the course of history have convinced us societally that certain people are leads and certain people are supporting players. Yeah. So a lot of my work involves that. Probably the most literal iteration of that is this stand-up comedy routine. Are you in Boston? Is that where you're based?
Yeah.
Okay, well, in the fall, you can see this show. Company One is doing this trilogy of mine in the fall. Is a show called Brahmani, a One Hijra stand-up comedy show, in which I take a South Asian intersex character and I make this person the stand-up in the stand-up comedy routine. But I also put the most leading man, blonde, handsome, white boy I can find and you can find and anyone in any theater can find off to the edge of the stage in half light purposely for the duration of the play. And it's not a punishment. I mean, that person is actually a very integral part of the play, but it is the most visible manifestation, I think, in all of my plays of this thing that I tend to do, which is say, this story is familiar to you. You know all about stories like this, except that I'm going to shift your lens and I'm going to make you experience great love, great tragedy, great fill in the blank while looking at this person who you don't normally look at as being in the center. That's snow that Nadezhda made. Mm-hmm. It's drying out now, though. Sorry. So I guess that's why.
Wow. I guess being an actress first. Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess if you want to speak more to how that influenced your writing, that's really interesting. Especially about characters that, you know, if you were cast in these roles that you just didn't feel connected to because they didn't, I don't know, was there something about that they just weren't very, like, complex characters that you were allowed to play, or was it, I don't know, that's really interesting.
I mean, I've worked at Mixed Blood Theater in Minneapolis, which has been my artistic home since forever and ever. So I've gotten a sweeter deal than most actors who look like me. That said, at some point, the fact that I just got to be on stage and get paid, which, holy crap, that's amazing. Yeah. At some point, that wasn't quite enough to excite me. And I was like, you know what? I want to get excited about whatever it is that I'm doing. And I'm getting bored. I'm actually just getting bored. And I still act at least once a year. I have this superstition that if I don't get on the stage for too long, I'll forget what we're doing. Like, I'll forget what that moment between the performance and the audience is, which is, that's the point of everything. That is theater right there between the performance and the audience. And if I don't remember what that is, then I get it all precious and heady and wordy and I don't even know, but it'll suck. So I get on stage at least once a year, but I'm crazy because I can be, and because I only do it once a year, I'm crazy choosy about what I do because it has to somehow excite me. And that usually involves pushing the boundaries of what is expected from someone who is female, someone who is brown, someone who fill in the blank, you know? I think that's probably the most boredom-inducing aspect of being an actor who looks a very specific way, is that in the stories that exist, like, I mean, I never even did the LA thing, and that was largely because I was like, God, the roles I'd be auditioning for, I'd be so bored. I can't even, it's a little different now. I mean, I feel like, hello, Orange is the New Black. Women can be all kinds of interesting roles now. But largely, oh, okay, so we'll pull you in for the waitress and we'll pull you, a nanny. I could do, and I mean, honestly, I just get bored. So I'm super choosy, but it's still incredibly important to me, that craft. And while I don't write, I've never written a play for myself to perform in because it just seems like a weird way to approach it. It seems like it wouldn't be enough of a reason to write the play, to write myself a role. But I do hope that I'm creating work that creates a more varied cosmos of the stories that are out there, and also creates opportunities for other actors to inhabit center stage in a new and more interesting way. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most, like, pleasurable and sometimes frustrating, but then ultimately, if it works out, pleasurable things about specifically the trilogy, the Displaced Hindu Gods trilogy that Company One is doing, is watching South Asian actors who are incredibly, like, deep in their bones, accustomed to being a supporting player on the stage, not giving you what you want because they're busy giving energy to everyone, and you're like, no, you're the lead. You have to own this space or it's boring. And watching them realize what it is to be the central character and own that space is kind of amazingly pleasurable. So, yeah, that.
Yeah. Which writers do you take inspiration from?
Mm-hmm. I kind of take free-form inspiration from anyone who makes art of any kind. because I feel like we segregate our art forms a little too much for my taste. I like the heady stuff, so I definitely have a bit of a thing for Tom Stoppard. Plus, I think I'm attracted to the fact that he's a foreigner, and I'm a foreigner, so his, like, lens on things is a little to the skew. He's not a foreigner anymore, I don't imagine, but, I mean, he had that, like, global thing going on, calling him a foreigner for no reason. Like, I'm deeply inspired by Toni Morrison, because I feel like, you know, she took the whole, I have a voice, too. And she was like, yeah, that's obvious that I have a voice, too. I'm making monster art, and you cannot deny me, you know? And I do feel like when you are of a marginalized group, there's this phase that happens where all of your art is about how you're marginalized. And so it doesn't get to play with the big dogs, and that's annoying to me. But Toni Morrison just kind of blew all that out of the water, so that is profoundly inspiring to me. I mean, the writers who, like, blew open what was possible through just words for me were probably some of the magical realists, like Salman Rushdie and Gabriel Garcia Marquez did that. I take quite a bit of inspiration from poets because I feel like that succinctness of expression is super useful to someone who works in theater writing. Yeats is a favorite, but just, oh, so many. I completely am inspired by Joss Whedon and, you know, that kind of, like, determined to entertain sort of storytelling, but that subverts society. I think that he has, like, a knack for the women, a knack for subverting what's out there in terms of women characters. I'm going to veer back to playwrights for a second. God. They're so, like, I have a couple of friends. These are two really close friends who I also just really admire their work are Cui Gwin, who runs Vampire Cowboys Theater out of New York, and he writes like, he calls it geek theater, he calls it lowbrow, and somehow he makes me cry at the end every single time. I don't even, like, yeah. I love what Christopher Diaz is doing right now. I love what Mona Mansour is up to these days. There's so many. Have you come across that, the list, the Kilroy's list?
I did, yeah. What did you think about that?
I love that. I love that they're making noise. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I love it. I love that they're throwing down. That's very cool.
I love the fact that it's only works that have been produced once or never at all. I think that's great. That really makes a difference.
Because I think to a lot of us, some of those are surprising. Mm-hmm. Like, I think in my head, a few of those titles on the list I'd assumed had been produced more than once, you know? And it's weird that they haven't been. And it's, and had they been just a titch more mainstream, I think they would have been. So, yeah, no, I think it's great. I think it's really, really cool. I hope it has an impact. Yeah. But there's a lot of amazing names on that list. Oh, my God, Paula Vogel's brain inspires me. That woman, oh, God, she makes my head hurt.
Yeah, she's, right now, she's my favorite player. I just really started diving into some of her work this year, and it's fantastic.
If you ever have the opportunity to either watch her speak or do one of her boot camps, just drop everything, because it will probably cause your brain pain, but you will come out of it smarter and wiser. And you know what it is? I think I'm profoundly inspired. So many actors inspire me, so many directors. I think I'm profoundly inspired by anyone who is, like, completely strong and unapologetic about the practice of their art. So anyone who goes at it with that kind of fearlessness, I'm like, yes, let us all be doing that, please. You know? And I mean, it was funny. I spent like 3 days at one of Paula Vogel's boot camps, and I came out of it feeling so much less lonely in the things that I find frustrating in traditional theater, traditional dramaturgy. Because there was this one like weird 20-minute period where she just marched around and she debunked everything that everyone had ever told me that a play had to be. And because she's a genius, she debunked it brilliantly. And I kind of wish I had like a recording device, because I can't for the life of me reconstruct the argument that she made. But she was absolutely, she was like, no, a character does not need to develop from beginning to end. A character can be static. No, a character. And I was like, these are all the things that I write, and I think that I believe in what I'm writing, but I don't have the equipment always to argue when someone goes, no, Aditi, a character has to have an arc and they have to grow. Otherwise, they're not a character. Not that I'm like full of those characters that don't, but I always kind of believed that that wasn't true, and Paula Vogel said it's not true, and now I know it's not true because I believe Paula Vogel. You know what I mean? And I don't know. It's really,
yeah, actually,
ferocious.
What are the myths that you think like a young playwright is told that you think really should be debunked? That's a really good thing to know.
Okay. Dangerous territory, because as they say, learn the rules and then break them. But one of the arguments, here's where I would like to see the training shift specifically for actresses. Actors too, but actresses. With my first play, which is not like, it's not a, it's got a lot of languages. It's called Love Person, and it's in ASL and in English, and with four Sanskrit love poems. But really, it's just a four-person chamber piece about love, right? So it's not like it's going to challenge the hell out of anyone, I thought. And yet, I ended up having the exact same conversation with whichever actress in whichever city was playing the exact role. It was the role of Vic, which is, you know, she's kind of a mess, and then at the end she gets the guy. This apparently was troubling and difficult to execute because actresses across America, if they had access to me, which it was my first play, I was accessible, you know, would ask me the exact same question in the exact same phrasing, which is, but am I likable enough? And to which I kind of started out with, who cares? Do you not want an arc? I mean, start out there and then evolve, and, you know. But will the audience believe that? And so I think what I distilled it to after a very, very long year of having the same conversation over and over is, in our greater narrative that we deliver unto young women in this world, if you're not nice enough, you don't get the guy at the end. That is simply what we say. Now, that's not true. Plenty of jerks get the guy in the real world, you know? Never have I ever heard like a guy playing Richard III be like, but am I likable enough? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
So insidious and strange and peculiar and sneaky. And I was like, but that's what's fun about you. It's fun that you're an absolute jerk and a drunk and you got all these issues, but you fall in love and you fight for that love and then you end up with the guy. And you're going to make it work. And hell, maybe a week down the line you guys get divorced. What do I know? The play ended. But that's the story. Embrace it, you know? Isn't that more interesting than, like, a Disney's version of that story where you learned your lesson and then you got the guy? I don't want you learning your lesson. That's why you're not learning. I didn't give you a lesson to learn, you know? So that kind of weird, insidious thing that sneaks up on us in our greater storytelling is something that I would like to shatter with a hammer. I would love it if our training for actors involved more work with new plays, because I think that the plays that are being written right now, for women roles specifically, women are emerging from acting programs unequipped to play them because their muscles are unused in that area. They're too accustomed to the canon, which does not, unless you do a whole lot of Eastern European work maybe, which does not equip you to play like a jerk of a woman who's still the central character and not like in the outskirts. To like all those really interesting roles that men have been training for and playing for centuries, they're being written now by playwrights who want to mix it up. I would love to see women coming out of acting programs and not asking me if they're not caring if they're likable, caring if they're entertaining, compelling, interesting to watch, if they're telling a story that's about something greater and exciting, but not if they're likable. That seems like a really, really, and I've had that question from directors, I've had that question from actors, and it gives me hives, you know? So I'd like that debunked, that women have to be likable or villainous. I'd like us to have a spectrum to play.
So about the likability, where do you think that stems from? Do you think it's from when they're being trained that, you know, that's the thing that they kind of keep getting sort of, I don't know, nailed into their brains, is that they need to be likable? Or do you think it stems from, like, the audience needing to approve the women characters in a play in a way?
I think it is Ophelia's job to be likable. In that play, it is part of the gig. If you did an unlikable Ophelia, you'd be screwing over the central narrative of the play. It's not your play. It's Hamlet's play. You complicated by being a jerk? It's not the right choice. It's the bad acting choice. I think it is Kate in Taming of a Shrew. She's a shrew, but it's her job to somehow get the audience on her side so that they're happy. And little help out from Shakespeare there, she learns a lesson. Therefore, she can now have the guy, you know? I think when you're a smart actor being trained in a certain canon of literature, you're going to do a good job with that canon of literature. You're going to do the job that you're assigned that uplifts the whole thing. And you do that over and over and over. And that's the story that you internalize. And that's the only story you ever get to tell, is the one where good girls get the guy and bad girls get burned in a horrible forest fire. I made that up. I don't know what play that is. Or jump off a wall and die off stage, because God forbid they get a stage death. Then that is the story that you internalize. That is the story that we spread through society, and we allow everyone in society to internalize. Stories have a huge amount of power. They're how we communicate about what's acceptable in our world, what is normal in our world, you know? So I don't think it's anything more in city. Like, I don't think it's like some sneaky, we're going to teach all the actresses in the world to be nice girls or to be bad girls and nothing in between. I think it's the fact that our canon is that limited, you know? And those are the roles. And I mean, I like to mess with everything, but if you cast me as Ophelia, I'm going to do right by the show. And I mean, you wouldn't cast, no one would cast me as Ophelia. But however, if your program also had, I'm going to go to a really huge extreme here because there are plenty of plays I could name, but just to use a reference point that we both have, if your program were to include a class in which you took scripts of Orange is the New Black and you all had to do those roles, I think you'd come out of that program with more muscle, more variety in your body, a way into more of the work that is currently being created. But right now, it's hard to cast women who are ready to get dirty, you know, with a role. You can find those guys for the Irish plays that have men who are dirty. It's hard to find the women always who are going to mix it up and get really dirty and be ugly on stage because, you know, we don't teach them that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, do you think women writers tell different stories than men writers? I guess you kind of touched on that earlier with sort of approaching things with a different lens, but
I mean, I think everyone tells different stories than everyone else. Whether there's something that is, I don't know, that's a good question. Whether there's something specifically female. I mean, I think I kind of on purpose. Hold on.
Are you talking to me?
No.
Oh, okay.
I very purposely populate a lot of my plays with a lot of subversive women because it's fun for me. And I feel like a lot of women writers these days are kind of purposely being activists that way. So possibly for that reason, yeah, because we're purposely trying to like shift the balance and populate the dramatic literature with those characters. I don't know if I would say that there's a general, like a more general difference than that. Like, I think Annie Baker writes amazing men. I think her men are awesome, you know, and really, really deep and complex and interesting. I can think of lots of male writers who write really gorgeous women. Tennessee Williams writes really gorgeous women, you know? There's a part of me that feels like maybe right now in this moment in time, women are writing grittier work, like edgier, grittier work. But I feel like I would attribute that more to this moment in time and what we're responding out of and into than I would to a gender difference. I have fluid feelings about gender anyway. And what it means and where we fall as humans in that spectrum. So yeah, I don't think it's a gender thing. I think it's, you want, in a healthy society, you want all the lenses and voices and perspectives mixing it up and being in dialogue. You don't want to be in a society where only the white men are having the high-level conversations. It's just unhealthy. That was a cat coming. The edginess thing that I feel like is happening right now with women writers, I actually do think it's in the way that we are of the world and the moment in which we write. I think that's maybe more about the moment than it is about gender. Though, I had this really intense experience when I was, way, way, way back. I'm going to name a movie, but it's going to be hard to find because it was an indie obscure movie then. It was called Just Another Girl on the IRT. And it was this, I feel like it was by a woman filmmaker. And it was about a young black woman in New York. And there was a pregnancy and there was a miscarriage. And there was this one scene where, without getting like, you know, voyeuristic or gross about it, the way the camera showed us what it is to have a painful miscarriage and the amount of blood that's involved in that and the fear that's involved in that, I was like, a dude would not show me that. A dude wouldn't know to show me that. A woman showed me that. I think in Alice Walker's, no, in Toni Morrison's Sula, there's this one weird moment about, I don't know, three phrases long probably, where this woman's baby is super constipated and she sticks her finger up and pulls out the little pellets to, and I was like, a dude would not give me that moment. It's just, that's a woman writing, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe in that way, because it's a different lens, you know, on the world. It's a different kind of ownership of certain kinds of moments, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which writer, yeah, sorry. Which writers today do you think are successfully representing gender on stage? You've given me some wonderful examples. Thank you so much so far for giving me all these examples.
Gender, female gender, or any gender?
Any gender, yeah.
I find the way Taylor Mack talks about gender super interesting. I mean, the answer is going to be what I find interesting. I don't know what a successful representation of gender is. So these are the things I think are neat. I do really get a kick out of Annie Baker's Men. They're so, they're so vulnerable. They're such a mess. Gender.
That's interesting, Annie Baker's Men being vulnerable, and it, like, I don't know, if, does that feel just refreshing in a strange way that, like, that these men are...
feels authentic.
Yeah.
It feels like people I know, you know? It's not that I was hungering for, you know, men who are a total mess on stage, but I know those guys, you know? And, there's other guys I don't know. That said, I like all of them. I like a variety. I want there to be a wild variety on our screens, on our stages, in our music. I want all of it to coexist. I feel like there's a... how would I describe what Qui does with his women? I mean, all of Qui's women in his plays are like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They're going to kick your ass, you know? Which says more, I think, about Qui and what he admires and respects and leans into than necessarily about the fact that every woman who walks down the street is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which... clearly not, but I love that that's in there. I love that that's in the mix. I love that that, like, you know that superhero fantasy? Well, I don't know if you know that superhero. I grew up on comic books, so, and I feel like the reason they're popular in a certain age range, certainly the reason that I was so into them, is puberty is such a messed up time, and you feel like you're at your most lost and weakest and vulnerable to societal powers and popular kids. And the superhero comic book genre gives you a way to fantasize your way out of that, you know? So I love that in the mix. I really, really do. I get a huge kick out of, I don't know if you saw Lisa Crone's Fun Home.
Yes.
Oh, super, like, I like her so much.
That was great.
That's great.
Yeah. Since I was on the comic book track there in my head. Other cool stuff. Okay, now I'm working my way around a circle I was sitting in recently. You know, I take a really deep visceral pleasure in Ellen McLaughlin. She does these reinventions of the Greek plays that feel to me deeply female oriented in a way that it's interesting. Ellen to me is one of those writers where I can't quite pinpoint what it is she does that gets me, but she gets me hard every time, you know? And she, the first time I ever saw her work was, I saw an adaptation of Oedipus that she did with Lisa Peterson directed, and I feel like Lisa Peterson is a director who tends to bring, like, subversive feminism to her work that I find super interesting. There's something to be said for me about really male stories and male friendships on stage, in a not generic leading man way, but in the machismo of that, of some of those cultures, you know. It's something that I'm tangling with right now for a new project that I'm working on. And I actually feel like the elaborate entrance of Chad Deity, the Christopher Diaz play, really tangles with that in an interesting way. Now I'm just starting to name my friends. I can keep naming things, but I can totally keep naming things. Yeah, no, that's not a gender thing. That's a poetry thing.
No, thank you, though. These were great. And no, I think that's really interesting, though, about, like, also male friendships on stage, too. And, yeah. So how would you define a strong woman character? Is it important for you to write strong women characters? If so, why?
To me, a strong female character is one that has all the complexity and depth of that a character that carries a show would need to have. It's more about, it has less to do with actual strength, whether it be physical or emotional, and more to do with holding the center of the narrative. For me, it's when the play is, like, I consider Linda Lohman a hell of a character.
Yeah.
What's her name, Linda? That is her name, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think they're great characters. And there is an argument to be made that ultimately somehow the play was actually about her, you know? Because she has such an interesting evolution in that play. I kind of feel that way about The Crucible, too. I feel like ultimately the most interesting character there was the wife, because all of a sudden everything turned. So it's not even about necessarily holding the central spot. It's about a kind of, like, ownership of the important spaces of the narrative. And just to balance history out, mostly about holding the central spot, you know, about it actually being about the woman. She can be the weakest, crappiest jerk who can't make her mind up in the world. And I would probably still consider her a strong female character, because so was Hamlet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Good point.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think it's dangerous, narratively, to lock ourselves into yet another box where we went first from, like, frail object of desire for, like, a century of literature. I would hate to see us switch to super strong, I don't need any help pocket, instead of just owning the whole spectrum of narrative, instead of just being fully present in the range of our humanity, like men get to be, you know? I had a conversation with a young woman at, I was just at this residency working on this fairly macho musical that I'm working on with the band, and she asked me why the central female character wasn't stronger, why all of her choices had to be guided by the men. And I was like, that's her reality. And she was like, yes, but I want her to be strong. I want her. And I was like, I'm not going to do that for you. You know what I mean? And her argument was like, but you're such a feminist. Why would you do that? And I was like, because I am a feminist. I'm going to write all kinds of roles, you know?
Yeah, cool.
And it is not my job to tell you that you're strong. That's not what I do. I make art, you know? And hopefully, if I make it enough and other people make it enough and we shift the way that we tell our stories in this world into a place where all of our stories don't have to be, I'm strong too, you know, then maybe things will shift then. But they're not going to shift just because I say I'm strong over and over. That's not actually how things shift, you know. So, I don't know. It's a complex, thorny, painful issue.
Have you ever started writing a play and the gender of a main character changed during your writing process?
That's a good question. Nope, they were lesbians from the start, I think. I don't think so. However, I have written plays where I don't care which gender you cast the roles. Yeah, no, there's a small chance, I can't remember the very early stages of it, there's a small chance that in my play Love Person, I might have shifted the older lovers from male-female to women. I think that shift came before I actually hit the computer. So I don't think so.
So do actors make a big influence on sort of how you envision a character when you first sort of see it workshopped or?
If someone's really great, yeah, sometimes. Yeah. If someone sort of like blows my mind open, there's a chance I start writing towards them. Mm-hmm. More often though, people I meet in the real world, I start to steal from them. Mm-hmm. And then I never, ever, ever tell them because they probably would not be pleased with the outcome. But more often than actors, it's humans that I'm stealing from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If or when during the writing process do you start thinking about the audience? Do you feel that you write for a certain audience?
I write for everyone, and I want them to come by the thousands. I perhaps write for the deep, heartfelt satisfaction of some imaginary 14, 15, 16-year-old girl who might find herself in the house having a thrilling moment on a particular occasion. Because that's where I was at the first time that I saw, I think it was the first time I saw a play and not a musical. And I'd only seen two musicals before that. I was like 14 maybe? And I saw an English-speaking production of Sam Shepard's Fool for Love. Oh, he writes interesting gender. I really like his gender plays. Well, I like the men and I like the women in his plays. They're deeply interesting to me. And he's alive, so he counts. Just had my little mind sort of crack open. It cracked open right around when May kicked the guy in the nuts and he fell to the ground. And then he just lay there while she took off her shirt, took off her bra, got a wet rag and wiped herself down under the breasts and under the armpits and got dressed for a date. All while he was sort of just laying on the floor. And I was like, holy crap, you know? What is this? I want a piece of this, you know? So I maybe somewhere deep in my soul am writing to someone who might have that moment. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Do you think about them when you write, though?
I think about them only when I'm like, ugh, this is getting boring. It needs to be better. It needs to be like that moment I had when I was sitting in the, like, I do it to push myself sometimes, to push myself to do the most amazing thing that I'm capable of coming up with. And I try, like, I feel like the only trick we've really got as artists is to, like, shoot for the best possible art we know is out there that we've ever seen in our lives. And that's the only way to get even close, you know? So, yeah, I think about that, the possibility of that moment for someone when I think what I'm writing sucks and it needs more. But mostly I try to write plays that are for humans, you know? And I think all humans should see them. I get really, really, I mean, by all means, let's do outreach marketing to people who don't go to theater enough because I think they're going to love it. But it's not like I write plays for Indian people, you know? It's not like they'll probably enjoy them, you know? Women would probably enjoy them, but so would men. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kind of theater do you think is the easiest to get produced? Do you ever feel pressured to create plays that fit in with this mold?
I don't know the answer to number one. And I don't with number two, but that's probably because I've set myself up to not be part of that conversation. Like, I don't take commissions if they tell me what to write anymore. I do take commissions from lovely people who essentially just ask, what are you interested in writing? And then if they like what I'm interested in writing, they'll go, maybe commission that. And that's working great for me. I feel like I'm in a weird pocket because I don't think anyone expects like a two-hander comedy, which actually I have a two-hander comedy because the stand-up is totally a two-hander comedy, but of course it's totally a weird one. I actually don't think, if I tried to write a traditional play, like whatever that is, and I actually don't know what that is, if I tried to write whatever it is that everyone tries to write so they can get produced, I think mine wouldn't get produced because why in the world would you want my version of that? I mean, plenty of people out there are equipped to write whatever this thing that I don't know what it is. The only value I really bring to the table is like the uniqueness of my voice and my perspective. So if I'm not writing that, I got no marketable thing, you know? What is it? Is it like a four-person family? I honestly don't know what it is. I'm sure someone could answer that question, but I actually don't know what that is. I feel like family plays, maybe, like living room conversational type deals might be popular in the world, but I don't think anyone wants mine. I could try to write it, but then they'd be like, why? So we come to you for the weird stuff. You can.
Are there characters or plays that you still haven't found a place for? Are there outside forces that have prevented you from writing these characters or plays?
No. I don't have any unproduced plays. I started writing kind of late-ish, so, and I take a really long time to finish a play, so I don't have stuff laying around. And I don't think I've ever had an idea, a strong impulse to write something that I have not either written or am currently writing. So, no. This is very mechanical, but I think theaters ranging from large to small to every random size are just spontaneously programming a 50-50. You know, that doesn't mean that that one theater over there can't have all men one season because that one theater over there happened to have all women one season. It's not that every theater is responsible for a 50-50, but actual parity would look like if you crunch the numbers across the board, and I'm including theater size in this equation because I feel like there's a lot of, we wouldn't care what the Guthrie was programming if it wasn't for the fact that the Guthrie gets all the funding. And so what they're doing is they're acting as a big funnel of all the large money available to artists and funneling it to a limited number of artists of a certain gender and color. On the whole, if they were just a mid-sized theater like all the rest of us, I would not care that the artistic director of the Guthrie really likes Irish plays. I'd be like, fine, go nuts. That's great. I'll come to you for my excellent Irish play. But because they're at a regional flagship theater that has such a humongous budget comparatively, the money you make there is so humongously different, there's a different responsibility there. So I would say 50-50 in terms of if you crunch the numbers across the board for things that are entering our dramatic dialogue as a society, but also in terms of where the money is going.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
That's a really, really important component because I don't need, it could be 50-50 for everyone except for the big theaters with all the money, but that would not be parity, you know? Yeah. Right. The money has to be flowing in a 50-50 way also. And I feel like there's a kind of, like, you have to work at it for a while, and then at some point the ideal would be, and that's when we would actually achieve parity, the ideal would be that you don't have to think about it because the work is there and the opportunities are there, and you can just choose what you like, and you've been expanded at this point to where what you like comes from a variety of sources and not just from your buddies who you already know, you know? Yeah, I think that would do the trick. We're like 50 years out, but you know.